You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
A very good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley and this is the show and podcast that brings you conversations that matter every week. And it is a big conversation today, episode 5 of season 2 of our special video debate series. You can catch all of these on video over at our special website for this, thebigconversation.show, and we've had some stonking discussions already this autumn and into the winter as well now. And today's is no exception. It's perhaps the feistiest yet of our Big Conversation series, in which you will be hearing on today's podcast and radio show Tom Holland and AC Grayling sitting down to debate whether Christianity gave us our human values. I'll be introducing them both in just a short moment's time, but do make sure to go to thebigconversation.show for the videos and, of course, to sign up for more debates, bonus content, updates and the like. As ever, if you want more from Unbelievable, just go to the webpage premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can get hold of the podcast, the app, the videos, the blogs and much more besides. And there's also the giving link there as well. And thanks to everyone who gave to the appeal last week. And on Giving Tuesday, I was encouraging you to give to Unbelievable and continue these conversations that we want to make happen. Well, thanks to all of those who did that. We hugely are grateful for all of the donations received towards this listener-supported programme. Still able to do that, of course, if you want to give, you can still receive the Unbelievable USA videos as a thank you for your gift of any amount. So go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on give if you'd like to do that. We're going along on today's show, so we'll just squeeze in a bit of feedback, hopefully at the end of today's programme, to that Origin of Life debate we had a couple of weeks ago, and I'll update you on some of the good stuff coming your way over Christmas and into the new year as well. But right now, let's get into today's special edition of Unbelievable, The Big Conversation, episode 5 of season 2. Welcome to today's edition of The Big Conversation here on Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. The Big Conversation is a series of shows exploring faith, science, philosophy and what it means to be human in association with the Templeton Religion Trust. Today we're debating history. Did Christianity give us our human values? The Big Conversation partners I'm sitting down with today are Tom Holland and AC Grayling. Tom Holland is an award-winning historian, author and broadcaster, the author of several popular books on classical history, such as Rubicon and In the Shadow of the Sword. His latest book, Dominion, tells the story of how Christianity, and most specifically, its central story of the crucified Son of God, came to shape the values of human dignity and equality in the modern Western world, in ways that modern secularists often fail to realise. AC Grayling is Master of the New College of Humanities in London and is a well-known philosopher, author and broadcaster himself. His most recent book, The History of Philosophy, traces the various schools of thought that have shaped modern culture. As an atheist and advocate of humanism, he's critical of the place of religion in society and fundamentally disagrees with Tom Holland's view of the unequaled historical value of Christianity to the West. So Tom and Anthony, welcome along to the programme.
Thank you.
It's great to have you both with me today. This is a big issue spanning literally millennia, so we're going to be doing a lot in a very short amount of time on today's programme. Really, really looking forward though to our conversation today. Let's start with you, Tom. Tell us a little again about what you sketch out in the opening to Dominion, which is the way that you actually personally changed your mind on the value of Christianity as you investigated classical side of history in some of your works.
Well, I think it's less of the value than the significance.
Sure.
The argument is not about whether God exists. It's not even about whether Christianity has been a good or bad thing, although I think that the values by which we judge whether it's good or bad are themselves broadly Christian. But this was a perspective that I was not entirely given to embracing. And that goes back essentially to my childhood, as I think for so many people's relationship to this issue does, because it's very personal. I think that in itself is a measure of how significant the influence of Christianity is on us, actually, that the degree to which we are shaped by it from our childhoods. But I was, as a child, I was brought up an Anglican. I went to church, I sang in the choir, I went to Sunday school. But to be honest, I found it kind of dull. The thing I really enjoyed, the thing that really kind of got my blood moving, was the classical world. And I liked it for the same reason that I had earlier been obsessed by dinosaurs, namely that it was big, it was fierce, it was extinct. And to be honest, I would have, you know, I was very much on the side of Pontius Pilate. the eagles, the togas, the glamour of it. And Jesus, kind of slightly dull in comparison. I mean, a loser, really. Mm. And so it wasn't that I, you know, there was a kind of a dramatic moment where I lost my faith. It was just like a kind of a dial going slightly down, a dimmer switch. Mm. And it was essentially blotted out by the sum of my fascination with the classical world. And so when I, in due course, came to write history, it was the Romans, it was the Greeks that I wanted to write about. But I found the experience of living in the minds of people like Caesar, people like Leonidas, the king who dies at Thermopylae, people who I had deeply admired as a child, kind of almost hero worship. Mm. I found it increasingly unsettling. Caesar was renowned among the Romans for his quality of clementia, his clemency, his mercy. But this was a man who, it is said, slaughtered 1 million Gauls and enslaved another, and was kind of cheered through the streets of Rome for it. Mm. And I began to think that actually these are so remote from me, so alien, that actually the kind of assumption I'd had that these were the seedbeds of my own values, my own assumptions, probably wrong. And so essentially over the past decade and a half, really, I've been kind of maneuvering myself towards writing a book which explores where I think ultimately the values of humanism, of secularism, of liberalism that I hold actually come from. And this was a quest that was sharpened for me by writing a book about the origins of Islam, where I was essentially making the argument that a lot that Muslims believe about the origins of Islam are actually mythic, are back projections. And it was a repeated complaint of Muslim critics that I would never dream of doing the same to my own beliefs and values. Right. So in a sense, Dominion is an attempt to do that, mm-hmm. to kind of trace the thread back of my liberal humanist values and to see where it leads through the labyrinth. And ultimately, it leads back to Christianity. And I've come to the conclusion that in almost all the essentials, myself, my friends, the society in which I live in, the whole of the West, is so saturated in Christian assumptions that it's almost impossible to kind of remove ourselves from them.
And you say almost that in the book that it's almost that it is so widespread that we almost don't notice it. It's the kind of water we're swimming in.
Yeah, well, the metaphor that was kind of on my mind when I was writing the book was, you know, if the West is a goldfish bowl, then it, essentially the water that we swim in is Christianity. But then after I'd finished the book, another metaphor struck me when I watched the HBO series Chernobyl about the explosion of the nuclear reactor in the Soviet Union. And what you saw there, when the reactor smashes open, you literally see the air ionizing, so you can see the radioactivity leaking. But the point of the story, of course, is that radioactivity is leaking, you know, it's reaching Kiev, it's reaching Scandinavia, it's reaching, you know, the sheep farms of Cumbria, and people are breathing it in and being affected by it and don't even realize often that they're being affected. I mean, I'm sure Anthony would perhaps approve of the comparison of Christianity to radioactivity. But I'm not saying that Christianity makes your hair drop out and kills you, but it changes you in ways that you may not appreciate.
And just quickly sketch out why that central idea, you say this in the book, is so important. You say the belief that the son of the one God of the Jews had been tortured to death on a cross became so enduringly and widely held that today most of us in the West are dulled to just how scandalous it originally was. Why is that image so important at the center of Christianity?
Well, the cross today is probably the most internationally recognizable cultural symbol that humanity has ever devised. The symbolism of it has been turned on its head. What the cross symbolized for Rome and for those who were subject to Rome was the power of the greatest empire on the face of the earth to torture to death anyone who opposed its rule. And governors of Roman provinces had the right to burn rebels, to throw them to the lions, or to crucify them. And of these three fates, crucifixion was regarded as the worst, as in a sense being the archetypal punishment for a rebellious slave. And the reason that it was so horrible was it was physically excruciating. There was no one way of doing a crucifixion. You could be hung upside down, you could be impaled, or you could have nails smashed through your bones. And to stay alive on a cross, you would have to pull yourself up and down, so you would feel the metal scraping against your bone the whole time. Birds would flock around your head. You'd be unable to beat them away. You'd be unable to stop them as they pecked out your eyes. You would be naked. And so hours, perhaps days, of excruciating agony would be endured. But worse than that, from the kind of the Roman point of view, it would be public. You would be a kind of billboard advertising your own humiliation and the power of the authorities that were putting you to death. And so the idea that this symbol of all symbols should, in a sense, have kind of been upended, that from degradation, the notion of triumph, from humiliation, glory, from death, life. And that more than that, the idea that someone who suffers the death of a slave emerges to become, you know, it turns out to be, in a sense, the creator of all heaven and earth and of all humanity. What that means in the long run is that it gives a dignity to people who previously would not have been afforded dignity by anyone. It embeds at the heart of the West the idea that the victim can triumph over the person who is victimizing him, and that the lowest of the low might in a sense be the highest. And these, in the context of Roman culture, it's hard to emphasize just how radical a concept that is, and therefore just how much of a kind of a detonation it is under the assumptions of Roman power. And the measure of how vast that explosion was is that now, by and large, we tend to take for granted that, you know, the lowest of the low do have a dignity.
Fascinating stuff. I'm sure, Anthony, you're going to have a lot to say about some of those issues. I was interested to see that your own book, The History of Philosophy, also begins by talking about Christianity, but in far less glowing terms, in a sense, than Tom's. One of the quotes from the introduction is, "Christian zealots smashed statues and temples, defaced paintings and burned pagan books in an orgy of effacement of previous culture that lasted for several centuries. It is hard to comprehend, still less to forgive, the immense loss of literature, philosophy, history and general culture this represented." So in a way, your book starts with a very different view of the significance of Christianity when it comes to our cultural history. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how that keys into your overall thesis in the book?
Sure. So let me make a general point first and then a particular one. So the general point is this. If you look at the larger picture into which the story of Christianity fits, then you notice that Christianity is, in all its various forms, based on a sort of reprise of what had been very commonplace tropes in the mythologies of the Middle East, right back to Sumerian times, so right back to 4500 BC and earlier. You know, the idea of the dying and resurrecting god, or the immortal who suffers for having done something for mankind, like Prometheus on his rock and so on. Again and again, the themes come up, and Christianity is just a version of those. You know, God making a mortal maiden pregnant, who gives birth to some extraordinary figure who does various things, including going to the underworld and coming out and joining Zeus on Olympus or God in heaven. These are very, very familiar stories. And they lie, it's a very thin covering over a scaffolding which is fundamentally classical. So mainly ancient Greece, also Rome. What those two great civilization-inducing epochs did was to transmit but refine much that had come to them in the way of art and architecture and government. But it added, I mean, if you think about the contribution made by Greece in philosophy and science and theatre and poetics and political theory and even sports and games. It's extraordinary. The vocabulary, the conceptual framework of pretty well everything that we think, the mind of Europe was forged and articulated in classical civilization. That's the general point. The particular point is this. If you ask, if you address the particular point that Tom is raising about the sort of ethical outlook of European civilization post Theodosius I, post 380 AD, when Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, and you ponder the question of what exactly is it about Christian ethics, the Christian ethical outlook, which is new or novel. Now, in the very, very early church, in the sort of apostolic writings, if you address them with the question, how should I live? How should I behave? The answer you get is a very extraordinary one. Give away everything you own. Take no thought for tomorrow. Don't marry. If your family disagree with you, turn your back on them. Now, this is the outlook of people who believe that the parousia was imminent, the second coming was just about to happen. And indeed, you know, many hundreds, maybe thousands of people went off into the deserts and got themselves on top of columns and what have you in order to try to live that existence, the complete denial of the world. And when it turned out that the parousia was taking a bit longer than people thought, they were consulting their gnomons and finding that, you know, time was ticking by, they needed more content. They needed something that applied really to the question of relating to your neighbours and having a life which was in some sense intrinsically good. Where did they get it from? They got it from the classical ethical tradition, imported pretty well wholesale from Stoicism is one of the leading sources for it, because of course the Stoics have come up with the idea of the cosmopolitan outlook, that everybody is a citizen of the world on equal terms and merits
that's
respect.
Very interesting. I mean, so essentially you're saying in the general point, Christianity was simply another version of the religions that had gone before. Mm-hmm. And on this particular point, you feel ultimately it only survived because it imported those Greek and classical philosophies ultimately, because its initial ethic wasn't livable.
And not just the ethics, but also the metaphysics, because you must remember that St. Paul said that the saints shall see no corruption, they won't rot in the graves. And when the church building began in the 4th century and thereafter, and lots of saints and martyrs were dug up to be taken as relics into churches so that miracles could be performed by them, they found that they had corrupted in the grave, they had rotten. And so the original Jewish conception of what happens at death, namely that you lie in the grave and you wait until the trump sounds and the grave's open and you come out, as St. Paul says, with a new body. I keep telling people that I like that bit about St. Paul because I want a suntan and a six-pack and so on. You know? But when that wasn't going to work out, they had to import via Neoplatonism, the Platonic doctrine of the immortal soul. This was a very late entry into Christian metaphysical thinking, 4th, 5th century. And of course, that was the period, too, when the canon was agreed and fundamental doctrines, the Nicene Creed under Constantine, the activity against the heretics in order to try to get some sort of compromise going. This comes very late, and it comes on the back of having to import a lot of thinking. Okay. And from then on, and I end on this point, yes. From then on, pretty well everything that you care to think of in the intellect of Europe, including the work done by Origen and Augustine and Aquinas and everybody else, is predicated on Greek philosophy,
right.
all the way through. So it's no surprise to find in the 18th century somebody like Hume saying, if only I had had Cicero put into my hands as a child instead of the Catechism, how much better off I would have been.
There's quite a lot to respond to there, Tom, but maybe we'll begin with that general and particular issue that Anthony sees. Christianity looked a lot like, actually, previous religions. It wasn't as a radical departure as you think it was. And was ultimately unlivable initially and had to import the classical views.
Well, I think there's a slight tension here in Anthony's argument. On the one hand, he's saying quite correctly that Christianity, as it emerges, is hugely influenced by the cultures of the world into which it was born, among which Greek philosophy is absolutely a part. On the other hand, Christians roam around smashing and destroying this culture. I mean, which is it? It's, it seems to me that it is evident that nothing comes from nothing. Christianity does not emerge in a vacuum. Greek philosophy is certainly an important aspect of it. Right from the beginning, you know, Paul uses Stoic terms in his letters when he's groping after, trying to explain what it is that he means about the law of God that previously had been written on the tablets of stone given to Moses, that's now written on the heart. And he gropes after the Stoic concept of conscience to explain that. But I think to imagine that Christianity is simply a kind of cladding over essentially a Greek temple is to ignore the obvious fact that the great influence, obviously, on Christianity, and indeed influence isn't the word, in a sense, Christianity is a river diverting from a previously existing river, is that of the Jewish scriptures, Judaismos, the Jewish way of leading a life. And Jewish scriptures, in turn, bear the stamp of other influences. They bear, most saliently, I think, from the point of view of the way that Christianity will subsequently emerge, they bear the stamp of Persian dualism. And that's crucial because what that does is to moralize the world. That's the great innovation of Persian imperialism, is to cast the entire world as something that is divided between realms of darkness and light, between lie and truth, between evil and good. So that also is a part of the fabric of what emerges as Christianity. And then, of course, there is the Roman Empire itself, which provides a kind of globalized state of an order that had not ever before existed in the Mediterranean. And the effect of Roman imperialism is, on one hand, it churns up populations through the process of enslavement, the transportation of Jews and Greeks and Persians and so on. So that's one measurable effect. The other is that it establishes a vast infrastructure along which people like Paul can travel. He can take the roads, he can take the ships. And so it's all these elements for the first time are kind of brought together. But Christianity does, I think, reconfigure it in an incredibly radical way. And as I say, it is, I think, this astonishing idea that a crucified criminal who suffered the death of a slave is in some way a part of the one God who has created heaven and earth. And Paul says that this is a stumbling block to the Jews. Why is it a stumbling block to the Jews? Well, partly because, of course, the idea that in some way a human being could be a part of the one God of the Jews is a kind of blasphemy to the Jews. But it's also this idea of there being a new covenant. And this is where Paul provides for people in the empire a notion of shared citizenship, an idea that there is no Jew or Greek, that draws on Stoic models, that is echoing the brute fact of Roman imperialism, but is enabling them to feel that the God who had loved the Jews now loves all of humanity. And it's that kind of reciprocal relationship that God loves you, that you can love God, that will prove incredibly potent in fostering this what will emerge as this kind of remarkable revolutionary movement. But Paul also says that the crucifixion is folly to the Gentiles, folly to those who are not Jews, because he recognizes the shock of the blasphemy that he is affecting. Antony's quite right that, of course, there are indeed examples of mortals being raised up to the heavens. And there's a very obvious one that Paul, in whose shadow Paul is wandering the empire, because the fastest growing cult in the first century AD is not Christianity. It's the cult of Divi Filius, son of the god, Augustus Caesar, who is the adoptive son of Julius Caesar, who has brought peace to the world and who has ascended into heaven after his death and sits at the right hand of his father. So the scale of the blasphemy that Paul is offering the Galatians and the Corinthians and the Romans is immense. He's saying that actually the real son of God was a criminal crucified by the Romans. But more than that, everyone in a sense, because of Christ's sacrifice, can be children of God. And he's saying that to the slaves, to the tanners, to the people in the mines, to the prostitutes in the bars. And this is such a radical recalibration of assumptions of the Greeks and Romans that it's the elites who matter, that these kind of people at the bottom have no significance whatsoever.
What do you make of all that?
Oh, well, I mean, Tom's being very emphatic there about a point which, again, is just another commonplace of the period. The reason why Augustus could be, described as the Son of God was because the concept of the Son of God was so widespread. All the heroes were thought to...
The
word is hero, yeah.
It's but not I mean, kind of crucified slaves.
Let us paraphrase. let's just see that people took the view of somebody who is in some way extraordinary, somebody who stands out, who has a great impact, who does some amazing thing or is extremely significant, must be the son of a god, because a mortal just couldn't do it. And I mean, this goes way back, pre-Homeric view of the egregious individual, to use that term neutrally. Now, just to go back to the point about contradictions, there's no contradiction between saying that the early Christians tried to efface pagan culture. They failed. They smashed a lot of temples and they burned a lot of books.
What evidence do we have for that?
Let me give you an example. We have seven of Aeschylus's plays, and we know the titles of 70. We have something like a dozen or so of Euripides.
What makes you think that we don't have them because Christians destroyed them?
Well, because the transmission of these things through antiquity, we know right up until the time of Cicero, right up until the time of Diogenes Laertius later on, how many of these documents had survived. And then
how do we know it was Christians who destroyed them?
Well, we know that Christians destroyed a great deal of the material culture of antiquity. All you have to do is just read about the first couple of decades after 380 under Theodosius I.
But do we have anything in the
whom
Theodosian
you don't mention? You don't mention the Theodosian attack.
Okay, so let's mention the Theodosian code. Right up until
529 AD. Hold on a second, okay. Tom. You had a long go there. Right up to 529 AD, when Justinian closed the school of Athens after 900 years of Plato's Academy was closed and the philosophers were driven out. There had been a systematic attempt to try to efface that the record and the remains of classical civilization in order to impose the Christian view on it. It didn't work in the end, because in the end Christianity had to absorb and adopt it. Look at Aquinas. The reason why Thomism is the official religion, the official philosophy, beg your pardon, of the Roman Catholic religion, is because Aquinas had to take over the Aristotelian corpus wholesale. So, you know, that in itself is enough of an example. You're trying to stress this idea that there was something really exceptional about the picture of Jesus as a, you know, he was a poor, he was a carpenter's son, he was tortured to death by the Romans and died a slave's death and so on. And this somehow is very special. On the contrary, it's just another example of a debate which had been going on for quite a long time in the classical period about the position of the individual and the relationship that individuals have to others. So, for example, in classical Athens in the 5th and 4th centuries, the idea of how you treat a slave... I mean, if you were to read some of the accounts of this, of manumission and of the right and proper method of dealing with your household servants and so on, you would see that ideas of respect and of kindness and liberality, oh yes, I mean, there are plenty of examples. Haven't you read Xenophon and Xenophon Economicus talking about how the wife in the household, in order to have a good relationship with her slaves, must treat them well and so on? I mean, there's...
The clincher on this one is,
Tom says that he cannot understand the mindset of a Caesar or a Leonidas.
Oh,
he finds them alien.
But you find them
alien in some way. Hmm. So I find Hitler's mentality after 1,500 years of Christianity equally difficult to sympathize with. Or indeed the general. Was it Tilly who was at the sack of Magdeburg in 1630? I mean, any number of examples of exactly the same kind of atrocity that occurred during the Christian period.
I just want to come back to this idea that bands of Christians roamed around destroying copies of Aeschylus.
Go ahead.
we have no evidence for this whatsoever. There's nothing in the Theodosian Code that prescribes that classical works should be destroyed. Indeed, we know that classical works were regularly copied by the monks that Antony is so dismissive of in the introduction to his book.
Several centuries.
But you say, remember that by this time, the Roman Empire of the East had been transformed into fully Christian Byzantium, no more interested in a careful and full preservation of pre-Christian culture than any other part of Christendom. And you say that insofar as the classical text survived, it was down to the Muslims. The Iliad was first translated into Arabic in 1904. Who do you think was copying the Iliad? How do you think we have Homer? Who is doing it? It's because Christians absolutely recognize that this is part of the fabric of their culture as well, that all good things, as Origen says, are part of our heritage.
Now, you should know, you will know better than I. You will know far better than I that the Nestorian region of the Middle East, or the northwestern Middle East, which was one of the first areas to be overrun by the Muslims. If you look at the library lists in the 10th century of Baghdad, the record kept there of the texts that had been preserved and were available and which were translated. That was the great period of translation.
And who do you think was translating them?
Yeah, the Arab and Persian scholars were doing so.
No, it's Christian monks who are translating them.
It's
Syriac and Greek-speaking monks who are doing the translating because it's the Greek monks who have the texts.
With great respect, it was the forget the name of the caliph now, who had a dream and said that these texts must be translated from the Greek into Arabic, and indeed that was the moment when contribution was made by the Arabic. So hold on one second. That library list preserved technical and medical and astronomical and mathematical texts from the Greek. Absolutely almost nothing at all of the literature, of the essays, of the theatre, of the plays, and some of the philosophical texts. For something like five centuries, about the only thing that was known of Plato was the Timaeus. And this was
In the Latin West?
In the Latin West.
But we're talking about, you're saying that in the Eastern Roman Empire, they were no more interested in a careful and full preservation of pre-Christian culture than any other part of Christendom. And yet they were transcribing the Iliad, they were transcribing the texts of the Athenian tragedians that we have, they were doing it, they were transcribing Thucydides and Herodotus. I mean, this is simply not true.
No, but you're being very selective there, because
these are the major Greek classics that you are saying that the Christians of Byzantium had no interest in.
And I go
and
on,
the reason for that is
I go on in that passage to say that the monks did begin to do those translations
it was the fundamental basis of the Roman classical education, and that passed through even when they'd been Christianized, and that's why they continue to copy them. And the reason why this matters is that this is such a basic point, and Antony is a great scholar and a professor, and you would think that this would be a simple thing for him to go and check. This is a myth that essentially is propagated in the 18th century. The figure who underlies it is Gibbon, with his account that the Serapeum is destroyed by bigoted Christians who destroy the library. And this is, to put it mildly, not exactly what happened.
Okay, there are two matters of fact here.
A quick response from Antony,
Which are independently verifiable. The first is that in the continuation of the passage that Tom is quoting from, I say that the monks began to do copying and disseminating later. About three centuries after the Theodosian moment, it really got underway. That quite a lot of the preservation of the texts that we have are owed to the Muslims, to Arab and Persian scribes who did a great deal of translating and were retranslated later. In the 11th and 12th centuries is when, for example, the Aristotelian corpus came back into the West. That's the first matter of fact. The second matter of fact is you can have a look. You can have a look at the amount of publication, of copying, of transmission in the three centuries between, well, maybe the four centuries between the fourth and the eighth centuries of the Common Era, how much publication there was, how much copying and how much transmission. How little was known in that period. You know, when people talk about a dark age, it's now, of course, fashionable to say it wasn't the dark age, there's a huge amount going on and so on. But how little was published, how little was discussed, how little was known in that period. And that is a matter of fact which is verifiable.
Quick response, and then we'll go to our break and we'll come back to this.
Okay, afterwards. I mean, I think this is really important. Monks were systematically copying. They were copying copying Virgil in the Latin West. They were copying Horace. They were copying Ovid. That's why they survived. In Constantinople, they were copying Homer. They were copying Herodotus. They were copying Thucydides. That's why they survived. The idea that there was a systematic campaign by evil Christians to eliminate the legacy of classical civilization could not be less true. And this is so clear and transparent a historical fact that it stupefies me that Antony could even begin to think otherwise. And I think the reason that he thinks otherwise is that it's a myth that he has a huge stake in. And we can trace the origins of this myth because the baddies in this are the monks. And this essentially is an 18th century updating of Protestant propaganda, which decreed that monks could never do anything and that, you know, the bigoted religious people of the Catholic Dark Ages had plunged Christendom into darkness. And Protestantism was all about bringing God's people back into light. Essentially, this Enlightenment myth-making is a recalibration of that. But instead of casting the early church as the model of light that has to be restored, we're now pushing the frontier back and saying that it's Greek philosophy. But it is entirely a myth.
We will come back to this, and we'll allow you to respond, Anthony.
On the question of being invested in taking a view, I'm afraid a two-quackway argument works
okay.
there.
Let's go to our first break. We're talking about history. Did Christianity give us our human values? Tom Holland and AC Grayling are my guests.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show. We're asking, did Christianity give us our human values today? As we look at history, and Tom Holland has written a very large book on that, Dominion, traces really the history of Christianity in the West and the way it came to shape our modern values. AC Grayling, Master of New College of Humanities in London, has also written a book on the history of philosophy and the way that various schools of thought have shaped modern culture. And we had a lot of disagreement in that last section, gentlemen. We're going to move on slightly from the question of what exactly the first Christians did with antiquity. And sort of move on to the question of just how far Christianity did ultimately shape the values that many people in the West hold dear today. Now, you were mentioning, Anthony, that as far as you're concerned, the slavery motif of Christianity and the way it brought the common people and the lowest person into this idea of being a human with dignity and intrinsic worth and so on wasn't necessarily somehow unique or radical to Christianity. You believe that was starting to happen generally in the culture that it came out of?
Well, I wouldn't argue that the idea was that we're all equal and that we shouldn't, for example, have slaves and so on, because after all, slavery existed right up to the 19th century, perhaps still exists in many different disguises today. So I'm certainly not arguing that, nor am I arguing that any period of history has been without its atrocities and cruelties and injustices. On the contrary, it always has. But if we think about the question of value, if we think about the examination of ethical ideas and ideals, the really striking moment in human history is the Axial Age. So we're talking about the 6th, the 5th centuries, the 4th century, before the Common Era. It's a striking fact about that period that in at least three great civilizations, of China, of India, and the burgeoning civilization of classical antiquity, there were thinkers who addressed the question of how should one live, how should one relate to one's fellows, and what kind of society should we construct. And it's a striking fact that three near contemporaries, Socrates, Gautama, who became the Buddha, and Confucius, who all lived sort of within a generation of one another, none of whom were prophets or preachers or religious figures who claimed inspiration from divinity, but who addressed themselves to the question of the good life, the nature of the good itself, and the good society. And the wellsprings of thinking, therefore, about the ethical lie with them. And in our own tradition, in the Western tradition, if you look at the Socratic challenge, which is what sort of people should we be, what values should shape and colour our lives, that question he put to his contemporaries and which generated that great debate, the first really significant ethical treatise is Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. It was one application of the Socratic idea that the life considered and chosen and thought about, the thoughtful life, had a chance of being a good life. The Epicureans, the Cynics, but particularly the Stoics, all of whom derive something from the Socratic moment. So the Stoics, for example, were very impressed by the kind of restraint and dedication to the thoughtful life that Socrates had advocated. And they are the originators of this idea of cosmopolitanism, the idea that we are all equal, we are all the same, we are all a part of the same world, and that this therefore places certain kinds of obligations on us. Now, one thing that people, and I'll conclude on this point, one thing that people misunderstand in reading and studying the ethical thought, especially of the post-Aristotelian schools, but even of Aristotle and Socrates, is best illustrated in the following way. When the authors of the Federalist Papers in the late 18th century were talking about a Bill of Rights and about amendments to the Constitution in America and the new United States, they had a debate about whether or not to include a provision that protected freedom of expression. And the argument that was put against that was, why have a positive permission to express yourself freely when we have it by nature? We don't need it. You don't need to make a positive provision for this because it implies that we don't have it already or that we need permission to do it. Now, that idea is commonplace through the classical period. It wouldn't have occurred to a male Greek citizen of Athens, because plenty of other people excluded the Xenoi and the women and the slaves and so on. But if you were a male Greek citizen of Athens in adulthood, you wouldn't have dreamt that you didn't have a right to your say in the agora. It was just an assumption. One of the greatest values in the ethics of classical antiquity was the value of friendship, the idea of your bonds with others and your obligations to them and your duty to protect their honour and well-being and so on. That was a very, very key concept, and indeed the great discussion in both Plato and in Aristotle of friendship. Aristotle devotes two entire books of the Nicomachean Ethics to this, generated a huge discussion, which actually caused Augustine and some others in the Christian tradition a great deal of trouble, because the Christians are taught to love everybody, so you can't love one person more than anybody else, so can you have friends? Mm-hmm. And Augustine agonizes over this in the Confessions. So, I mean, it's very interesting to go back behind some of the tropes that have been appropriated by people who think that their ethics is Christian to the source of those ethical outlooks, which is classical
ethics. Which, as you say, as far as you're concerned, if Paul was doing anything, he was simply building on what was already an established basis on in terms of those ideas. What's your view on that? Did Jesus and Paul change what Aristotle and Plato?
I know began? That Antony did not take the chance to argue that the way the Spartans or the Athenians treated their slaves should be regarded as in any way the wellspring of our own views on human rights or equality today. And he also doesn't make what is, of course, the obvious point in this, that Aristotle believed that barbarians were naturally suited to be slaves of Greeks. And in arguing that, he was absolutely part of the current of the age, because by and large, different people tended to view themselves as superior to their neighbours. I mean, true of the Jews, definitely true of the Greeks, absolutely true of the Romans. And the assumption is that foreigners, by and large, are suited to be slaves of Greeks or Romans or whoever happens to be the
master. White Americans with regard to
Africans. We'll come to that. So,
but it's the same thing. I mean,
it's not the same thing. When Paul says that there is no Jew or Greek, there is no slave or free, there is no man or woman, the justification he offers for this is actually founded in the idea of slavery being set aside, that someone who suffered the death of a slave has triumphed over power, has triumphed over the kind of mastery that, in the classical sense, is the expression of the right to hold a slave. And I want to focus on one particular aspect, because I think that this is kind of very measurably influential on the way that we conceptualize things today, and that's the issue of sex.
Okay.
And so there's a common idea that Christian sexual morality is kind of, you know, repressive, puritanical, boring, square, something that we have to jettison. Mm. And absolutely the idea that Paul is some kind of hung up guy who just turns up and, you know, Greeks and Romans are all having great fun and orgies and stuff, and Paul turns up like the massive party pooper and ruins everyone's entertainment. But actually, Paul's the doctrine of sexuality that Paul preaches is deeply founded in his idea that slavery is something to be overcome, and that everybody has been liberated by the sacrifice of Christ. Because what he is saying is that every human being, by virtue of Christ's sacrifice and death, now has a value. And he specifically says that they have a bodily integrity, and that every man, every woman, every child has, that their bodily sacrality is a reflection of, if in the case of a woman, of the church, and in the case of a man, of Christ himself. And so that's to give a dignity, say, to a household slave that he'd never been given before.
Because they could be used as sexual objects.
But absolutely, they were expected to be used as sexual objects. The Romans had the same word for urinate and ejaculate. And essentially, the mouths, the vaginas, the anuses of slaves were regarded as akin to urinals. These are objects in which bodily fluid can be ejected by the master. And that is their role, absolutely taken for granted. So the radicalism of Pauline and ultimately Christian teaching is to say, no, that isn't true. Everybody's body, no one has the right to have that done to them. And more importantly, that then means that there is an obligation on the male citizen, the master, the lord, to control his sexual appetites, because he is not allowed to do that. And so Paul's idea of lifelong matrimony as a kind of image of the marriage of Christ in the church embodies, it sets in train a radical, radical reconfiguring of the way that people in what will emerge as Christian civilization come to think about sex and come to think about marriage. And I think, by and large, pretty much everyone now takes those assumptions for granted. And we can see that. I mean, you know, in the 60s in particular, there was this kind of sense that, Christian morality is boring, let's get rid of it. Let's rip it up. Sexual revolution. Let's go back to kind of the hedonism of pagan days. Let's be Dionysic. Of course, the Greek god Dionysus was a rapist. All the Greek gods were regular rapists. It enshrined the idea that males had the right to use their inferiors in any way that they wanted. And that was something that essentially over the course of the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, we know what the consequence of that was. And we see that now with the Me Too movement, which essentially is an attempt to reimpose Christian sexual morality. And the paradox of this, and there are so many paradoxes that surround this, is that women who go on marches in support of Me Too will dress up in the costumes of handmaids from Margaret Atwood's novel and the TV adaptation of it. And that, of course, is written as a parody of Puritanism. Mm. Yet essentially what they are demanding is that men
control themselves
and essentially behave as Puritans. Mm. And the truth is that Me Too would only work, it would only have the resonance that it does, if most men accepted the validity of what women protesters were saying. And I think that by and large they do. And I think that that is, I mean, if that is not evidence of the saturating effect of Christian teaching over 2,000 years, I don't know what is.
Oh, okay. So I'm completely with Tom on in support of the Me Too movement, and I think men should be restrained and they should be courteous and we should be equal and so on. But I have to say, I don't really recognize very much of what Tom is saying there about the Pauline view on these matters. After all, it is Jesus himself in the Gospels who talks about monogamy and one flesh and so on. St. Paul says, don't marry unless you're about to burn. If you're incontinent, then marry. And also women, they've got to shut up, cover their heads and sit at the back of the church and not speak. So his attitude towards women wasn't very good. Droit de seigneur of Christian aristocrats all through the Middle Ages and afterwards, the presence of slavery.
This is another 18th century myth.
Okay. Oh, come on. Let's allow come on. Finish.
This is not an 18th century myth. In the 19th century, white Americans were enslaving black Africans or black people of an African origin and treating them with the same kind of view that you say Aristotle treated the barbarians, that they just fit for slavery. That's all they are. They're second-class human beings or third-class human beings. Christianity, if after 1,500 years, if it hadn't managed to pervade, infect, or radiate our culture sufficiently to stop slavery until the 19th century, seems to have been an extremely weak force. I mean, everything that you attribute to and use as a kind of charge against pre-Christian civilization can be iterated endlessly, alas, and tragically, in
Christian
the period after
culture.
Theodosius. Yeah.
Well, so it's absolutely true that that in the Caribbean and in the American colonies, slaves do start increasingly to be African, and so what gradually happens over the course of the 18th century is that slavery becomes racialized. And so the issue of whether there is a fundamental difference between the white slave owners and the black slaves becomes an issue that people across Anglo-America have to debate. Now, ultimately, the stress of this, the evident fact that, you know, if there is no Greek or Jew, then there is no black or white, is one that comes to rack the consciences, first of Quakers, then of evangelicals, and then ultimately the whole span, first of British and then of American society. And it reflects a conviction that the heart will be illumined by the spirit, that the law of God will be written on the heart, and if we want to read it properly, we have to look into our heart and we have to do what that law is then telling us. And that is what animates the Quakers. That is what animates the evangelicals. So that in the span of a century, what had been a kind of mad minority opinion by the beginning of the 19th century is convulsing parliaments, is convulsing presidencies. And over the course of the 19th century, we'll see slavery, something that as a Muslim Sheikh said to a Royal Naval officer when the Naval officer demanded that he abolish slavery, said, but why would we? Every age has accepted slavery. Essentially, this kind of that is bred of a radical Protestant idea of the flame of the spirit illumining the heart and enabling people to see what should properly be done. That is something because first of all Catholics and then Muslims are not Protestant, it's been kind of universalized. But essentially, the impetus behind it is this kind of radical Protestant interpretation of how the spirit can move people to act properly, that in turn, of course, draws on the mainstream right. of Christian inheritance.
Now, there is one very big difference between attitudes towards slaves in the pre- and the post-Christian period. Aristotle's father-in-law had been a slave. He rose to be the ruler of the city-state to which Aristotle went after studying with Plato. That was a not uncommon thing, not to become a ruler of a city-state, but to be freed and to become eventually to become citizens and to be able to play a full role. I cannot imagine a black slave in 18th or early 19th century America ever been given that opportunity. And this is after 1,500 years of Christianity. I mean, I'm afraid to say that to look at the Quakers and the evangelicals of the 18th and 19th century, not a moment too soon did their consciences come to prompt them to do something about slavery. But it seems to me itself to be a proof of the fact that the conscience, the outlook, the ethics of the Christian period, in that respect, as in many others, was no different from the other.
Do you think that then the impetus against slavery was not primarily a Christian one, but was something more of a rationalist enlightenment sort of philosophy coming to bear, even if it was having a Christian expression?
Yes, I think so, because it was in the towards the end of the first third of the 18th century that I forget his name now, but he was a Huguenot who had gone temporarily to England and then on to North America, and who was a teacher. And in the evenings, he taught the children of slaves and found that it was that what he'd been told about the lower intellectual capacities and so on of black children than white children was just simply false. And it was he who began to agitate a bit among the Quakers at that period. And this is, it's not an accident that this is in a period of time when the grip of the major religious denominations, like, for example, the Catholic Church or the Calvinists, over the minds of people and their insistence that they adhere to a particular way of looking at things. This was the period when that was loosening, and so it made it possible for people then to think differently, even about those doctrines.
So essentially the argument is because we were becoming less Christian in a way, less dominated by Christianity, that slavery was ultimately overturned. What's your view on that?
Couldn't be. I mean, it's so fundamentally, it's so clear that the anti-slavery movement is an evangelical one. And absolutely, there were any number of freed black slaves who toured around Britain, who became lions of the hour, who were celebrated and fated. Absolutely they were. I mean, what happens, though, is that this great evangelical impetus, which sees Parliament petitioned, which sees Castlereagh, the Foreign Secretary, rather like Theresa May, having to go and negotiate Brexit when she doesn't believe in it. He had to go and negotiate at the Congress of Vienna to argue that slavery should be abolished, even though he didn't particularly believe in it. Castlereagh's genius is that he is able to persuade the Catholic powers that they too should have a stake in that, because he couches it in the language of rights, which derives from Catholic canon law going back to the 12th century. So he's able to do that. It is also the case that he is able to draw on elements within, let's call it, the Enlightenment tradition, which absolutely also recognizes that people are born free and equal. But in turn, I think it's important to ask, where do these ideas come from? And I think that this really is the kind of the nub of the disagreement between us, that Anthony sees this, the Enlightenment, as a kind of a radical break with what has gone before, that there is a kind of middle age of superstition and darkness that intervened when all these book-burning monks appeared and started ransacking everything. And then in the 18th century, praise the Lord, the light comes on and everyone is enlightened. My perspective is that the Enlightenment is simply another iteration of a series of convulsions that have racked Christian civilization and are bred of deeply Christian theological concepts. And it's in that sense that the international law that emerges to deal with the abolition of slavery is able to fuse Protestant, Catholic and Enlightenment traditions, because ultimately all those traditions are bred of the same matrix.
It's interesting, this point that you obviously, Tom believes you simply can't stand outside of Christian history, even things that seem on the face of it to almost go against, Christianity, the Enlightenment, even modern day atheism and secularism, I think Tom would argue, all find their roots in the Christian revolution, if you like.
I know that's the thing I disagree with. Well, what I don't disagree with, of course, is that, especially from, let us say, about the time of Gregory the Seventh up until the Reformation, so from the early 11th century up until the beginning of the 16th century, the church in the West was incredibly powerful, and it wielded a great deal of temporal authority and influenced hugely the politics and society of the time. But if we're really talking here about the intellect of Europe, we're talking about the mind of Europe. Tom's subtitle is something like
the making of the Western
the making
mind.
Of the Western mind, or something.
In the British version, I think.
Yeah, yes. And the idea that from the Renaissance recovery of classical texts and outlooks, and the huge influence on it. I mean, you can take little examples. Think of the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer comes out of the Gospels, right? It's apostolic. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy will be done in earth as
thy kingdom come.
Okay? Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. Okay, and we know that one of the cardinal sins is pride. That is, that your own will. I mean, you can stand on your own feet. And in Islam means submission. So, you know, in these young religions, Christianity and Islam, this idea of submission to God and not relying on your own intellect or your own powers. But there in the Renaissance, so this, we're now talking several hundred years before the Enlightenment, we're talking about a very long development of liberation, really, from this hegemony over the mind that the church had tried to impose. We get something like Pico della Mirandola, Oration on the Dignity of Man, on the idea that human beings and the human mind and the endeavor to understand without reliance on, you know, ancient scriptures and so on. You look at the philosophical revolution and the scientific revolution of the 16th, 17th centuries are precisely predicated on the idea of the kind of inquiry premised on observation and reason, setting aside the authority, whether of the church or of some great figure of the past like Aristotle, because the revolution was against any form of authority. In 1492, a year in which Columbus, much to the surprise of the people who lived in America, discovered America, driving away of the Muslims from Spain. A very, very significant thing happened in that year, which is unnoticed. It's like a little, you know, mice-sized mammal in the age of the dinosaurs that Tom has always loved so much. And this was the publication of a book called On the Errors of Pliny by a man called Leoncini, who had gone through the natural history of Pliny and had discovered many, many, many errors there. And this was in itself revolutionary, because for so long people had looked at authorities, the fact that so few people were literate, that things that were written, scriptures, it is written, it's therefore has great authority. And in the Renaissance, you had the repudiation of that and the insistence that we should look again and think again and make use of our own powers. That's what led eventually to the liberation of the European mind from efforts to control it by dogma.
So lots to respond to there, Tom. But first of all, this idea of the hegemony of the mind, you know, that essentially the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment were freeing people from...
I think Anthony is being suckered by the marketing of intellectuals that has persistently gone on over the course of European history.
This sounds like Gove on
the
expert.
The Renaissance is not the Renaissance. There were many Renaissances. An earlier Renaissance,
of course there were,
in the 12th century, for instance, saw the university system established that Anthony presides over to this day. And that is, again, absolutely expressive of an idea that... There exists a God who has created humanity and has given him sufficient logic to fathom the laws with which God has structured the universe. Now, this is not in any way a given. The idea that there is a single creator who has fashioned the entire cosmos and who has structured it by laws, and that we know from the evidence of the original covenant and then the new covenant that he is happy to submit himself to laws, even though, of course, he reserves the right to exact miracles if he wants to. Nevertheless, this is an understanding of how the universe functions that facilitates what, by the 19th century, for instance, will come to be called science.
Now, Tom, now, come on. Look, firstly...
And then again, if we go back to the Carolingian age, again, we have a Renaissance, because this, again, is structured by the idea of Alcuin and the sponsorship of education, that learning is part of the fabric of that God has given humans. And again, it's this kind of humanist idea that all of wisdom is there to be absorbed. So these are... The idea that there is a single Reformation is as big a mistake as assume that there is Renaissance is as big a mistake as assume that there is a single Reformation. Right. There are many reformationes over the course of Christian history, because this idea that society has to be remade, that the people who've walked in darkness have to be brought to see a great light, that the world has been lost to superstition and idols must be overthrown. This is part of the core narrative. It's part of the core myth making of Christians right from the beginning. It's what fuels the conversion of Europe in the early Middle Ages. It's what underpins the great process of Reformatio initiated by the papal reformers in the 11th century, this idea that all of Christendom can be refashioned. It's certainly a fundamental part of the Reformatio, of the Reformation, when it's the Catholic Church that becomes the object that gets cast as the object of superstition. And we've seen the same cycle happening with the Enlightenment, where it's Christianity itself that comes to be cast. But it's still a Christian narrative that is being exemplified, even if it's overtly anti-Christian reasons.
Let's try and get this right, okay? So the development of schools of higher learning in the medieval period was a rediscovery. After all, as I said earlier, for nearly 1,000 years from the institution of the schools of Athens in the 5th century, a university system in all but name existed, schools of higher education. They were closed by a Christian emperor in 529 in Athens, and it took some time before the necessity of a more advanced education, or even indeed any education, to come back into the picture. The medieval universities were law, medicine, and theology. This was because the growing centralization of power required bureaucrats, who required educated people who could write, who could manage taxation, who could run a kingdom. So, you know, this wasn't just a matter of trying to understand God's plan for the universe. This was this was itself a rebirth of an educational ideal that had been founded in classical antiquity. On the question of Renaissances, again, you know, Trump talks about using a particular kind of mythos here about what happened when. And it is now the sort of fashion among historians to find any number of Renaissances and Reformations and so on. And indeed, in a way, there were. But let us remember that Petrarch is the person who made a very explicit claim to the effect that his age was the one in which they had rediscovered and were bringing back into the light the great values that had been suppressed and lost during the darkness of the period that he described as the age between, the middle age, the medieval period. So this was a self-conscious recognition by people like Petrarch and all those who therefore went mad looking for manuscripts and digging in old library collections and so on in order to get manuscripts back.
Who had written the texts that were found in these libraries? Indeed. And where do these libraries exist?
I have not denied. And you didn't read out the little bit of the thing where I said that later on we owe some thanks that the little that did remain of classical literature was preserved for us by monks later on.
Well, it's AC Grayling and Tom Holland joining me, Justin Brierley, for episode 5 of season 2 of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. Hope you've been enjoying it so far. The final part coming on its way very shortly. And do go to the website of thebigconversation.show for blogs, resources, and to sign up, of course, for the newsletter, where you'll get bonus content and updates as well. We'll be back very shortly.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue,
we invite leading scholars to unpack the gospel accounts of Jesus' birth and explain why we can have confidence in these stories. Plus, we speak with the indomitable Anne Widdecombe ahead of the general election and explore our alternative Christmas gift guide, with ethical and sustainable gifts for all budgets. All this and more in December's issue.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/free sample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and we bring you conversations that matter every week, and especially big conversations like today's one between Tom Holland and AC Grayling, and we'll hear the final part of it very shortly. A much anticipated debate, this one, and if you want to watch the video, which it's well worth doing, by the way, because both of them got quite animated in this one, then do go to thebigconversation.show and do, of course, make sure you're subscribed to the newsletter to get updates and bonus content. Coming up next week on the show, it's still a big one, actually, because renowned Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne is joining me to debate the soul. He holds to a view of the immaterial soul. He'll be arguing for that against Luke Janssen, who believes that we are ultimately physical. So listen out for that, or watch it again. We're going to be making sure to release a video of that too over at the Unbelievable YouTube channel. Coming up straight after Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, on the profile between 4 and 5, Father Nadim Nassar joins Megan Cornwall to talk about his role as the founder of the Awareness Foundation. He is the only Syrian priest in the Church of England, and he'll be talking about his childhood, growing up, the death threats he's received, and his work as a peace builder in the Middle East. That's on the profile between 4 and 5 and available, of course, from its own podcast as well. Again, a quick word of thanks to all those who've been giving towards this show. Thank you, all of those who responded to the Giving Tuesday appeal on last week's edition of the podcast. You can still get, as a thank you gift for your donation, all of the video sessions from this year's Unbelievable Conference USA that was filmed out in California. If you want to do that yourself, then do go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on the link to give, and that way you'll be sent the sessions as a thank you for your gift for supporting the show. And just briefly, also got a Christmas offer for you as well for the loved one in your life who loves apologetics. Why not get them the Unbelievable Christmas Bundle? It consists of the Unbelievable book, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists I'm Still a Christian, signed by my own fair hand, and of course two DVDs as well, the last two conferences here in London. So if you want to get hold of that, you can get it obviously on digital download as well. That's available as an option. Then why not go over to the Premier shop? You can get there by going again from the Unbelievable show page and clicking on DVD download, and you'll see that there's the offer there for the special edition Christmas bundle at a much lower price than if you bought all of those items separately. So that'll be with you before Christmas if you order it fairly promptly. The signed book and two Unbelievable conferences for a very special price. Towards the end of today's show, we'll get your feedback as well on the Origins of Life debate we had recently. Right now, back into the final part of the show between AC Grayling and Tom Holland. Our big conversation on history and did Christianity give us our human values? We've just got a little time to conclude our discussion, and what I do want to finally land on is right up to date, really, is what you really represent today, Anthony, which is the modern incarnation of humanism, particular kind of secular atheistic sort of humanism. When I've seen you speak on this and what you write about in the book, really makes it look as though it's sort of a given that once we simply recognize who we are as humans, we will inevitably treat each other with dignity, with respect, with equality, and so on. We don't need Christianity, as it were, to give us those values. They would have at some level come to us by simply using our reason and intellect and so on. Whereas Tom, in his book, says, well, you know, the Beatles, if you like, were the pop equivalent of the humanists of the 60s. All you need is love. John Lennon's, you know, hymn to secularism. Imagine there's no heaven. Imagine there's no religion. We'll all be a wonderful brotherhood of man. And again, his point is, they simply miss the point that all of that is utterly steeped in the Judeo-Christian ethic that their culture comes out of. It's impossible to escape that. Humanists are essentially Christians, but they've simply rejected the kind of supernatural elements of what Christianity gave them. What's your response overall to that? And then we'll have Tom come.
Well, I mean, it's just an assertion, which you know has no. it fails to recognize that the mind, the ethical mind of Europe, the whole framework of its concepts, its very vocabulary, comes to us from classical antiquity. It comes to us from the what I called earlier the Socratic challenge. It comes to us from the effort made by the Aristotelian school and by the Stoics principally to think these things through. The idea that we owe something to one another because of our humanity has never prevented people being cruel and vicious and selfish and greedy, today as 10,000 years ago. But the roots of our best thinking about these matters and how we're to relate to one another lie in our commonalities as human beings. I mean, I often describe humanism as the view that our most sympathetic and generous view about what it is to be human, human nature and the human condition, both very difficult to understand, but the great diversity of human experience requires a kind of sympathetic pause in order to try to work out what it is about somebody else's choices and desires one can accept or must not accept and so on. This is the idea of applying reason and consideration to that.
And in that sense, humanism, secular humanism, is a result of that enlightenment thinking, the scientific approach, the rational approach, owes more to that than any particular Judeo-Christian roots.
Very much so, and I would say its deepest roots lie in what I, in fact, in print, called the First Enlightenment, which is the period of classical antiquity.
I think it's a tendency on the part of intellectuals and perhaps particularly philosophers to overemphasize the significance of philosophy. Clearly, it's important, and I think mediated through Christianity, Greek philosophy has obviously had a profound influence on the way that people in the West think. But I think that the key thing about Christianity, which was recognized by Origen, in the third century, is that as well as providing a framework for the transmission of philosophical ideas, there is a kind of mythic quality to Christianity. Origen says that he contemplates the fact that the creator of the world was born and cried for milk, and he finds this so stupefying he doesn't know what to do with it. He just feels struck dumb by it. And I think that it's the parables that Christ tells. It's the notion of the nativity, it's the drama of the passion, it's these mythic resonances that have been transmitted down the generations, and in an absolutely saturating effect, children have been brought up in these stories, they have then told their children, and so on. And for centuries and centuries and centuries, Christianity was essentially the only game in town. And even up until, the 1950s or 60s, essentially there were Jews and there were Christians. And there were those who had ceased to be Christian. The question then is, to what extent are humanists, have they emancipated themselves from Christianity? Are they are they indeed part of a kind of a global movement? I think Keynes famously said that the things that that people tend to think is often due to kind of weird stuff that an economist years before had said. I think that's true of all of us. I think it's that essentially we think the way we do because of stuff that theologians centuries and centuries ago made an argument, or because of kind of mythic passages in ancient scripture. So I think the idea of humanism, the idea that humans have a kind of unique dignity, that have a kind of special status, ultimately, I think it goes back to Genesis. I think it goes back to that narrative that God creates man and woman in his own image. And that is something that then passes through into the bloodstream of European culture. And we, to this day, continue to take for granted. And so the emphasis on the kind of the idea of the human, the idea of human rights and the values and the dignity of humanity, I think that this is a deeply Western and therefore a deeply Christian idea. And as kind of illustrate, I just wanted to read a list of where international human conferences have been held over the year. We have Miami, we have Oxford, we have London, we have Oslo, we have Washington, we have Paris, we have Noordwijkerhout in the Netherlands, then we have Mumbai, then we have Mexico City, then we have Amsterdam, then we have Brussels, then we have Buffalo in the USA, we have Oslo, we have Hanover, we have London, we have Amsterdam, we have Boston, we have Paris, we have Oslo, we have London, we have Amsterdam. Mumbai aside, all of those are in countries that are deeply, you know, are predominantly Christian. In turn, most of those are Protestant. I think that in its essentials, humanism is a kind of a very soft Protestantism. It's a godless Protestantism. Mm-hmm. And it is, in that sense, as culturally contingent as everything else in the vast range and span of human civilization. And I don't ultimately see what the problem is with acknowledging this.
Right.
I mean, if you don't believe in a God, it no more matters that you as an atheist might be informed by Christian opinions than that you as a human being are an ape. I mean, it doesn't seem to me a problem.
Humanism is divorced from the Judeo-Christian ethic. Or
yes, I am, because I mean, if I were able to identify focal humanistic traditions in non-Christian societies, then you might believe that humanism is something that could quite easily come out of reflection and consideration. So it happened in classical antiquity in Greece. It happened in the thinking of Aristotle and the post-Aristotelian schools.
Do you believe that those...
It happened in China two centuries before Christ. Mao Zedong, the founder of the Maoist movement, taught love your brother, love your neighbor as yourself. This idea, it's a very, very, very fundamental humanist principle, that one. The Jains and the Buddhists in India, centuries before Christ, were teaching the same thing. Not only compassion, an all-embracing compassion, but not just for other human beings, for all life, for animal life. I mean, something more tender in its outlook even than the Christian view. These are recognizably and focally humanistic impulses that we're recognizing in these different traditions. They don't owe anything to any one particular tradition. They come out of this sense that we have as human beings of being connected to one another. There's a marvelous remark in one of Hazlitt's essays where he and Coleridge went for a walk on the North Somerset coast, and they came to a village where the day before there had been a terrible storm and a boy had been swept out to sea, and the fishermen in the village had risked their lives to try to save him. And Coleridge asked them, well, why did you do that? Why did you risk your lives to do that? And the fishermen said, it's because we have a nature towards one another. And that encapsulates something human that doesn't require myth. It doesn't require myth in the case of the Jains and the Buddhists and the Maoists. It just requires a sense of our common shared humanity.
But the idea that humans have rights, that they have a peculiar dignity, is a myth. And it seems to me so evident that this myth is Christian in its origins. The idea that by cherry picking fragments from other cultural traditions, you can demonstrate that the beliefs that you hold as someone living in London in 2019, you and all your fellow humanists, all of whom, with the single exception of one city, have all been held in basically Christian countries. Humanism is so derivative of Christianity. And yet, because, like Christianity, it wants to claim a universal mission, just as Christians claimed as evidence for this that Greek philosophy was part of its inheritance, so likewise, you are engaged in this mass exercise of cultural appropriation, picking stuff to demonstrate that the entirely contingent views that you personally have, and that I have too, are somehow not bred of the culture in which we've emerged, but are in fact somehow universal. I mean,
Thomas is engaged here in an act of attempted appropriation to one tradition in one part of the world of things that are manifestly and obviously predate by many, many, many centuries across the globe, ethical impulses which humanism happens to capture. I would ask Tom this, and this is a surprising question maybe, to nominate for me one thing, just one thing, that Christianity has introduced that doesn't have some source, some parallel, some analogy in previous and in other civilizations. One novelty, one innovation in thinking about anything, ethical, metaphysical, anything you like. And I must say, I've racked my brains over this often enough, and I cannot think of one. Would love to hear if there is one.
Do you accept that challenge?
Absolutely. I think the ideal of lifelong matrimony, I think that's a very distinctive Christian concept. I think the category of what by the 19th century is coming to be categorized as homosexuality and heterosexuality, I think they have no precedence. I think the notion of secularism, the idea of there being religions, I think all these are entirely exclusive to Christian civilization. I think the concept of science as it emerges in the 19th century, I think is entirely exclusive to Christian civilization. I think the idea that human beings are created in the image of God, that is obviously something that Christians share with Jews, but that is it gives a degree of dignity to human beings that no other cultural tradition that I'm aware of even remotely approximates to. So I think that all of those are and essentially what I'm talking in giving that is I am talking about what makes Western civilization distinctive. And one of the things that absolutely makes Western civilization distinctive, and it's an inheritance of its Christian past, is its assumption that its values are universal. This has been fundamental to the way that Christians have understood their faith, that it is for all of humanity. And to this day, the heirs of that cultural tradition want to believe that their values are not contingent, but somehow are the property of all humanity.
We are down to our last few minutes, gentlemen. How would you like to conclude things?
Just by reminding Tom that the Stoics were universalists, that if it is true that no other culture had ever privileged monogamy, then this can scarcely be regarded as a particularly great achievement. I can't really think of anything of major significance. The distinction between heterosexual and homosexual, I mean, that was a distinction that was drawn as early as the Pentateuch. You know, we have to stone to death people who lie, a man who lies with a man as with a woman and so on. So there, some kind of a distinction.
That's not
is
homosexuality.
Operative.
I mean, I don't think we've got time to get into this argument. But the thing is that you see, that is a classic example of the way in which even Antony, this dogged atheist who rejects the fact that he owes anything to Christianity, his assumptions about homosexuality and heterosexuality are so deeply rooted that he assumes that a man sleeping with a man is equivalent to the category of homosexuality. It isn't. I appreciate we don't have time to argue why, but I would just say that for those of you watching who want to know why homosexuality is a distinctively Christian category, buy Dominion.
Well, it wasn't a great contribution in that case. Well, it is distinctively Christian.
But actually, I'm not talking about whether it's a good or bad. I'm talking about, you know, this is the thing. I'm not offering value judgments here.
You've given me so little that you can claim is distinctively Christian contribution to world thinking.
An entirely radical way of seeing sexuality, of relations between the sexes, of the category of the secular, the idea of I think these are all fairly seismic innovations.
No, but it's a bit like saying, you know, we've created a problem and we can ameliorate the problem slightly by doing such and such. I mean, secularism is a great example. The church in medieval times wanted to get the temporal powers off their backs, and so they introduced the idea of secularism there very asymmetrically because
it goes back to Augustinian theology and then ultimately back to the Gospels. I mean, everything that you and I and Justin think is down to theologians, fragments of scripture from long, long ago.
I think you really want this to be the case, don't you? You really do. And
no,
you've appropriated
it's a conclusion.
It.
No. It's a conclusion that I have come to from doing what I think that you that everyone should do, which is to look at the evidence and arrive at a decision.
I agree. Let us look at the evidence.
Final points
always.
Then. Yes. Yeah. Well, look, it's been really marvellous. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this very passionate discussion between the both of you. Antony and Tom, thank you very much. I know you are going away disagreeing on this, but I'm very glad that we had the chance to air our conversation today. Thank you very much for joining
Thank you.
Handshakes?
Yes, of course.
Very good.
Well, that was quite the debate, wasn't it? Thanks again to AC Grayley and Tom Holland. I'll make sure there are links to both their books from today's edition of the podcast. And make sure to watch it as well in full video Technicolor glory at thebigconversation.show, because it did get passionate at points, and that really comes through on the video. And while you're there, get subscribed to the newsletter. That'll give you updates, bonus content, and all the debates as they're made live, and even before they're made live, because actually a number of people got to watch this ahead of its public release on YouTube because they were newsletter subscribers. And that's the kind of good stuff you'll get if you become a subscriber. The next big conversation is coming up after the Christmas break, so I'll give you a little idea of who we've got. Some very exciting guests in the wings for that in a couple of weeks' time. And big thanks again to the Templeton Religion Trust, who have made all of these big conversation shows possible, both season one and season two. If you want to get in touch about today's show, do send me an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or tell me your thoughts on social media, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. You can find me on Instagram as well as Justin.Briley. Right now, though, time for a little bit of your feedback. First of all, Ed Atkinson has been in touch, great friend of the show, and one of the organisers of the Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group that happens on a monthly basis in London. Well, their next meeting is on the 6th of January, usual location, the Cock Tavern, Phoenix Road near King's Cross, for 7:30 p.m. Kicking off 2020 with a great topic and speaker, the evidence for the resurrection. And who better to present that evidence than Jonathan McClatchy, very well-known apologist and very much a friend of the show. So come along there to hear Jonathan and to discuss it with Christians and skeptics. Again, you can find more details at meetup.com. You're looking for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. And planning on having Jonathan on the Unbelievable show as well at some point in the new year as well. Probably doing a similar sort of topic. So you'll get two bites of the cherry if you go along and see him in London as well. Thanks to all those who've been in touch about the origins of life debate. And it was quite an interesting one. Lee Cronin, who works as a chemist, who was looking at ways of looking at how life could have started organically, chemically, in the very early history of the Earth. He was in conversation on that one with Dennis Noble from Oxford University, and Perry Marshall, who has instituted this Evolution 2.0 $10 million prize for anyone who can crack the mystery of the origin of life's information. And mixed reviews to that show, I will say, because a lot of people wanted to hear a harder kind of position put against Lee Cronin's view that there is a chemical explanation ultimately for life that they're getting towards. So I'm going to start off with a really long one, actually, but I think well worth reading this out in full as a response to that show. It's from Paul Rimmer, who himself is involved in origins of life research. He's a postdoc at Cambridge University and wants to say, first of all, that the following opinions are my own and in no way reflect the opinions of colleagues or the institutions I work for. But the episode on origins of life was great. All the guests were excellent. Great to see Lee Cronin on there presenting some of his research. I am fond of his open approach to the problem, trying all sorts of different things, and completely agree with his philosophical point that if the conditions are right, life will be inevitable. The problem is that the conditions may be very unlikely, and Lee seems far too dismissive about the magnitude of the problem. This is, in fact, my only serious criticism of Lee's presentation. I think starting life is hard, so hard that brilliant chemists like Lee Cronin, John Sutherland, Matt Pauner, Ram Krishnamurthy, Thomas Carroll, Steve Benner, Jack Sostak, to name a few, have made continual progress towards a solution, but the solution is so far away that it's hard to figure out which of these chemist trajectories is most closely oriented towards the answer. The origins of life on Earth is more than origins of information, but that is part of it. For there to even be an origin of persistent information, some chemical substrate needs to hold that information, and there needs to be machinery to copy that information and make use of it. In spite of what Dennis Noble says about proteins, a chemistry is needed to hold and transfer the information before there can be evolution. And so far, no prebiotically plausible molecular substrate except nucleotides has been discovered that can do this work. Proteins are prebiotically plausible, but have not been shown capable of storing or copying information. Proteins cannot make copies of themselves. Lee's newest system can, but it can't, as of yet, carry messages. I've read Lee's paper on spontaneous formation of autocatalytic sets with self-replicating inorganic metal oxide clusters. Catchy title. Where he presents his work with salt. The work is beautiful chemistry, and it may well win the prize Perry Marshall spoke of. I don't know what requirements the prize actually has, or what the allowable initial conditions are, or what the final conditions have to be to qualify, but I don't think the paper actually has much relevance for origins of life on Earth. Lee uses molybdenum clusters. I'm just hoping I'm pronouncing some of these scientific words correctly, Paul. You say to build other clusters and larger clusters and different kinds of clusters, but none of the clusters were shown to keep any specific information from the prior clusters. What is the information content of these clusters? The paper doesn't say. What does this information content affect within the system? How can it pass on new information from generation to generation when there are no actual generations? As far as I could see, these questions are not addressed. After asking Lee some of these questions and getting a very helpful reply, I have a better idea about the context of this paper and the potential for future work in this direction. The system can't encode information, but that's beyond the scope of the paper. In the future, if MO clusters can encode and transfer messages, I still also don't see how these systems will be able to avoid the error catastrophe. The required fidelity does not apply only to DNA or RNA, but to any chemical information, storage and replication. The copy error rate for single information-rich structure needs to be on the order of 1 by the number of bits of information. So if you want to store 100 bits, you need to have a system with 99% fidelity, or there will be no evolution, no useful memory, no life. And it seems a system like DNA, along with enzymes, will be needed to achieve such a fidelity. Molybdenum, or table salt, or olive oil, will not do. The most important thing for me to emphasise, which may be irrelevant to the prize but is central to the origins question, is that it seems unlikely that the molybdenum replication system could ever develop into anything like life as we know it on Earth or anywhere else. It seems unlikely that the initial clusters would spontaneously form anywhere outside of a chemistry lab. And it's unclear how they would incorporate and transition into carbon-based life that we know today. If the work is taken to imply that any chemical system can easily become alive, then why doesn't silicon? It's about 100 times more abundant than carbon, which is itself 1,000 times more abundant than molybdenum. So there's clearly no way, without a chemist present, to get the molybdenum system to start on early Earth, and no clear way to go from that system to carbon-based life. I don't think the work Lee mentioned on the show contributes much to solving the problems of origin of life on Earth, but maybe his future work along these lines will, and much of his past work has, for example, on peptide ligation, Formose chemistry, on mineral surfaces, amino acid-directed nucleotide synthesis. I don't think other scenarios yet proposed do all that well, either, including my own. Many of, in my opinion, the most promising pathways towards origins of life are disconnected with both geochemistry and biology, better suited to round bottom flasks than warm little ponds. Connecting these scenarios is important, and it may be many of these scenarios will fall apart during the attempt. Those that survive may become much more plausible if the right initial conditions exist and subsequent circumstances occur that may imply that life originating this way is very rare. Life may be relatively common or rare, based in part on how common or rare the conditions needed for life are and how hard or easy it is for life to originate. Future exploration into exoplanets and maybe other objects in our solar system will help us figure out how common life is, and this will set a bar of plausibility that origin scenarios will need to meet. I think there is a scientific explanation for how God fashioned the first life, just like there is a scientific explanation for how God fashioned snowflakes. I personally favour the scenarios involving both proteins and RNA together at the outset. That research direction has recently been very productive and is, in my opinion, a more promising direction to go. But I think there's a long way to go, and it's not at all clear yet exactly what the full solution will look like or how long it'll take to get there. 20 years from now? Maybe 50 generations? Or how likely it is for the solution to be found anywhere else in the universe? But I'm glad people likely are looking. So there you go. As I said, it is a long one. And Paul Rimmer, this is very much his area of expertise as a fellow researcher at Cambridge on origin of life issues. So thank you very much, Paul, for such a fulsome response to that particular programme. And as I say, mixed reviews to the show, because some people really wanted to get more of an intelligent design perspective on, or something at least that went against the proposals that Lee Cronin was putting forward. And so Nelson in Vancouver, Canada said it was for a frustrating to listen to, Perry on the one hand clearly sees the problems inherent in origins of life research, but rejects intelligent design as a God of the Gaps explanation. That's strange, because it seems to me that intelligent design is as much a possible explanation for the origin of life as is chance and necessity, unless you've precluded the possibility of design in advance. On the other hand, we had two scientists spouting long disproven theories for how life may have arisen. When you drill down to the probabilities, it's clear that the emergence of life was literally a miracle. It was an occurrence that was practically impossible. It would have been good to get Stephen Meyer on, as he wrote a book extensively critiquing chance and necessity hypotheses. And a similar thought from Carrie in Missouri, who said, your shows are always thought-provoking, but I didn't enjoy the format with Lee Perry and Dennis. There wasn't anyone representing the ID perspective of the origin of life question, or even skeptical of Lee's claims. How can we evaluate the soundness of an idea if we don't hear another argument? I'm the layest of laypersons when it comes to science, so I found myself thinking, I've no idea what might be the difficulties with what Lee and Dennis are proposing. And there are difficulties always with any perspective, Christian or non. I honestly didn't even know where to look for an opposing viewpoint, but there was a ray of light. You briefly brought up James Torr, whom I'd never heard of. I looked him up, and he has quite another story to tell. The fact that he's a chemist as well would make him a perfect opponent for Lee, and I would dearly love to see that matchup. As I always appreciate Unbelievable, thank you for what you do. Carrie, your wish is my command. I am in the process of setting something up between Lee and James Torr, and I think that will be a great follow-on show, actually, to that. And as I said on last week's show, Jim Torr very rarely makes himself available for this kind of an interaction, but because so many people got in touch with him after we put out that Origin of Life debate, he said, all right, I give in, I will do this. And Lee graciously is looking for opportunities in his diary for us to make that happen. So looking forward to bringing you that at some point in the new year. But for now, thank you so much for joining me on today's edition of the show. We range far and wide on Unbelievable. Chemistry, science, philosophy, ethics, history, theology, you name it, we do it here. Hope you're enjoying what we've brought to you so far this year. Coming towards the end of our year now, and looking forward to lots of interesting shows coming up in the not too distant future. Got a debate on Hinduism coming up soon, and Christian evangelism. That'll be an interesting one. Got a special holiday edition of Unbelievable when I'll be talking to some people who have both been influenced by the show, telling their stories, telling us about some of their recent work. Some fascinating people joining me for special holiday edition of the show, and some fantastic great stuff coming up in the new year, including of course episode 6 of The Big Conversation early on in January. So look out for that one as well. But for now, thanks for being with me on the program. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. You're unbelievable. We're keeping those big hitters coming as we debate the soul, and in favor of the immaterial soul, renowned Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne joins me. He's got a new book out on that subject. And he's going to be discussing it with Luke Jansen, who takes a physicalist approach to the soul. Luke is, in fact, a Christian, but he doesn't believe we have an immaterial soul. They'll be debating the science of that, the philosophy of that, on next week's show. Hope you can join me for it. In the meantime, thanks for being with me, and see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.